This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.
On today's BizNews briefing, President Trump's short-lived ceasefire, the fate of Iran's nuclear program, Afrikaners are back in the United States, and are Deputy President Mashatile's lottery numbers up? Stay tuned. It's Tuesday, 24th of June. I'm Stuart Lohman. President Donald Trump says a ceasefire between Iran and Israel is now in effect, but fighting may still be underway. He posted the message on Truth Social, warning, please do not violate it, Bloomberg reports.
Just get us up to speed in terms of the latest then on this apparent truce, this apparent ceasefire.
Well, President Trump has posted for the second time in 6 hours that there is a ceasefire. A short while ago, about 10 minutes ago, he posted saying the ceasefire is now in effect. Please do not violate it. But from what we understand, in the last couple of hours, there have been a series of attacks. IDF has said that Iran launched 6 waves of missile attacks towards Israel. A short while ago, the AP reported that Israel had closed its air skies. And we're now hearing that they could be actually on the verge of resuming and reopening them. But the death toll reported this morning has now climbed to 4 per AP. And equally, on the Iran side, we have heard of the air defense systems being activated. Now, all of that happened before Trump posted a couple of minutes ago. So maybe we should actually take him at his word that the ceasefire is about to go into effect. But we have no official confirmation yet from Israel. There's been no confirmation that Israel have actually agreed to the terms of a ceasefire. And all we have from the Iranian side as of yet is a post that the Iranian foreign minister put up overnight saying that they had no ceasefire agreement, but that they would stop military attacks on Israel after 4 a.m. Tehran time. And that obviously did not come about. So a post now from Trump warning both sides not to go down the route of violations. I should also say in the earlier post that President Trump put up announcing this original ceasefire, he also warned, and this is important for where this goes from here, that additional strikes could be forthcoming if Iran does not negotiate a deal to restrict its nuclear program. So yes, there's this big announcement of a ceasefire, but what happens from here, Tom, is going to be crucial in terms of where the diplomatic channel comes from, whether Iran would actually sign up to some of the concessions that the U.S. are asking for, and if indeed Israel would see this ceasefire as a lasting ceasefire or just a temporary truce.
The fate of Iran's nuclear program and attempts by the U.S. and Israel to destroy it could hang on the Islamic Republic's more than 400 kilograms of uranium enriched to levels just short of weapons grade, the Financial Times reports.
So those U.S. strikes on Iran over the weekend, did they actually destroy Tehran's nuclear program? That's been the big question since America's military joined Israel to bomb key facilities. But the answer is, well, it's complicated, and a lot of it depends on a stash of enriched uranium. Here to talk to me about it is the FT's Middle East editor, Andrew England. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. So first of all, Andrew, tell me about the stash. What are we looking at here?
Well, Iran has been expanding its uranium enrichment program since about 2019. They've been enriching at about up to 60% purity, which is very close to weapons grade. It's normally regarded that 90% purity is weapons grade. And so they've been going pretty much close to that. Before the war started, Iran had amassed about 408 kilograms of this uranium enriched to 60%. That's enough fissile material, if it was further enriched to 90%, to produce about 10 nuclear bombs if they chose to go down that path.
Got it. And what do we know about its location? Is it in one spot? Is it spread out?
What experts tell me is that essentially it was in 3 locations before Israel started its war with Iran about 10 days ago. So Fordo is the main plant used to enrich uranium to 60% purity. Natanz is the second main site. And then there's another site called Isfahan. And it's worth remembering that IAEA inspectors, UN watchdog inspectors, were able to visit these sites.
Yeah, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And Andrew, where is all this enriched uranium now?
This is a great question. We don't know. We assume that the Iranians knew that Natanz was definitely going to be bombed. Fordo would be bombed. It's deep underground in a mountain, so Israel didn't have the military capacity to attack it alone. And that's when the US joined the conflict and dropped 30,000 pound bunker buster bombs on it. But we can assume that the Iranians prepared for all contingencies, and so more than likely moved it.
And just to be clear, if Iran can still access this enriched uranium pretty easily, how long might it take for Tehran to potentially make a nuclear weapon?
Well, Iran always says its nuclear program is for civilian peaceful purposes, but the fear has been that they could have installed advanced centrifuges in undeclared covert sites, ramping up their nuclear activity and producing uranium to the highest levels of enrichment they've ever done. I should say that the weaponization process is a whole other matter, and it would take months, up to a year, experts say, to actually weaponize it. So it's one thing having the fissile material required to produce a nuclear bomb. It's another matter having the skills and expertise and the technologies to weaponize it in a way that could actually be deployed.
So Andrew, just plainly, it sounds like there isn't too much of a threat coming from Iran's nuclear program at the current moment, but it could escalate over the course of time. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think what experts would tell you is one of the risks with a bombing campaign against the nuclear sites is it doesn't get totally destroyed. You can't destroy the research, technical know-how, experience that Iran has built up over these last few years. And that if Iran is still able to retain this highly enriched uranium, and if it still has facilities, then there is a risk that if Iran chose to weaponize its program, then yes, it could.
That's the FT's Andrew England. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Freedom Front Plus leader Corne Mulder is in Washington, pushing for partnerships with the US and not punishment. He says the ANC's foreign policy has alienated the West, and he's offering alternatives. He's with Linda van Tilburg.
I think there are recipes, proven recipes of what successful countries do. And if we could get South Africa to understand that. And the problem, as far as I'm concerned, we've got the wonderful opportunity with the government of national unity. But we've got two vast problems within the government of national unity. And those are the following. The first one, that foreign policy remains the exclusive domain of the ANC. That's their domain, and they don't allow anyone else to take any role within foreign policy. So because of that, we have positioned ourselves as an enemy to a very large extent of Israel. We've positioned ourselves as an enemy of the United States and broader Western influence, as the ANC is pushing that agenda on behalf of government, which is not correct. Secondly, the one thing that brought us all together within the government of national unity is the ideal that we should have economic growth and job creation. But the fundamental economic policy underlying this is still the ANC's policy based on black economic empowerment, expropriation without compensation, affirmative action. And that those are the things that we believe has got a stranglehold on our economy and the prosperity of South Africa.
But don't you think the Trump administration already got that message from all the previous visits?
Well, the message for what they basically received in the Oval Office was that South Africa is a very violent society. That discussion was about crime being completely out of control. The one participant after the other gave their own expression and own interpretation of this violence. We want to come with a positive thing. We are not here to complain. We are here to say, let's put a deal on the table that can address those issues to the benefit not only of South Africa, but also as an opportunity for the United States.
Some lawmakers are looking at possible sanctions of ANC. They could be leaders or ANC members. Would that be under discussion?
Well, we are meeting with Congressman Ronnie Jackson, and he is the one that is proposing that specific bill. That's the bill that looks at the different bilateral setup between South Africa and the United States. And that is a very damning bill. If you look at what that bill basically says, for paragraph after paragraph, it lists all the things that South Africa has done in terms of positioning ourselves in contradiction to what the United States' interests would be. So we will have a discussion with him. We are also of the view we don't want South Africa to be punished. We don't want South African citizens to be punished. But it's not in our hands. If the United States decides to take certain steps, it will be up to them. We won't have any influence on that. We are not interfering. We are doing what the South African government should have done over the last many years. They haven't done what they were supposed to do, and that is to inform not only about what's happening in South Africa, but to come with constructive, positive proposals that will benefit the majority of South African citizens. And if that is a problem for the ANC government, then the problem is not with us. The problem is not with South African citizens. Then the problem is with the ANC.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Hudson Institute Senior Fellow Joshua Maserbi hosted a webinar with Corné Mulder, Theodor Jager, and Gerard Papenfuss, all part of the delegation to the United States. They provided context on the state of South Africa. Let's listen.
You see, in land reform, it is very seldom that title deed is given to the beneficiaries. So these farmers who are beneficiaries of land reform, they are delivered to the state. They are tenants of the state. And they cannot give their land as collateral to access financing for production. Hence, they wait for the state to give them money for the inputs, their fertilizer, their seeds, their mechanization. And if government does not give it to them, they cannot pay their electricity, they cannot pay their wages. And they are struggling. I want to see well-established white farmers making a success out of the situation where which we are expecting these beneficiaries to make a success of. So after 30 years, a very small portion of the food which we buy from shelves and shops come from those farms. And of course, it creates more and more tension. We are creating a situation where we, again, have two kinds of farmers, white farmers who own their own land and black farmers who are tenants of the state. And the difference in terms of competitiveness and profitability becomes bigger and bigger. Now, the solution for the ANC is to take land at less than market-related compensation so that more land can be given to black farmers from the same budget. This is the new Expropriation Act, which was passed earlier this year already under the Government of National Unity, but it was voted in Parliament already a year ago before we had this Government of National Unity. Now, our problem with that is, of course, first, what kind of democracy do you expect the individual to pick up the bill for a national imperative such as land reform? Why must we, as farmers who bought our land, pay for a national imperative? Well, we bought at market value. But more than that, here, like in the USA too, very few family farmers have a pension fund. We all farm until we are too old to continue with our farming, and then we sell the land, we pay the bank and the cooperative what we owe them, and with what is left, we retire. The ratio between what we owe as farmers and the value of land in total is more or less 60%. We owe more or less 60% of total value of our land to the banks and the cooperatives. So if they would expropriate us at 60% of value on average, the bank and the cooperative will get their money and we will walk out naked. And this is why we are fighting this new law so hard.
South Africa is now governed by a government of national unity, but the ANC, which is the strongest party, represent 40% of the population, but they act as if they have a majority. That's a communist, socialist, Marxist, nationalist movement. That's what it is. And they combine all of these things into their policy. They are busy driving South Africa towards a socialist state, and they mix that with black nationalism. So what has that caused? South Africa is an economy in decline, has an economy that's in decline. Now, we sit here, all of us heavily invested in South Africa. We want to make it work. But let's get to the point where we explain what is happening. Our growth rate is just above 0%. The population growth is faster than that. So we are a state in decline, and that needs to be turned around. That's what we're all busy with, working towards. But the fact is, South Africa is the economy is in decline. And within this declining economy, the South African government is busy with a process of transformation. The first part of that is employment equity, where they want to change the color of the workforce. And then they interfere in business, and their program is Black Economic Empowerment, BEE. And this is destroying the South African economy, because what they want to do is they want to frame each and every deal around that, as long as a white man doesn't get advantage out of that deal. Now, you must remember, there was apartheid, and all of that was wrong, but the fact is they inherit a very strong country with a very strong economy. And if you want to exclude a portion of your population, no country in the world can afford to exclude a portion of his population, take them out of the economy. So what is happening here, this is a system of systematic persecution of a particular type of person. And what, who is suffering as a result of that? Everybody. They want this particular class of people to suffer. But who's really suffering? Everybody. And strangely enough, and sadly enough, Black people, people that they wanted to uplift, are suffering the most as a result of that. The divide, inequality is increasing. South Africa has 63 million people. 47, and if I'm a million out, 47 million people are the people over 18. 29, almost 30 million of these people live on government assistance, government grants. Can you imagine? 70% of South Africans, 70%, needs monthly allowances from the state to survive. Because of this policy, and that is the reason of the decline in South Africa, is this policy, which they call Black Economic Empowerment and Employment Equity, that is the reason for the economic decline of South Africa.
Josh, I would just like to add one thing with regard to what Gerard has basically said. The ANC government started off with Black Economic Empowerment after 94 to address the wrongs of the past. And in theory, it sounded good. But now it's 30 years later. And if it was successful, we should have narrowed the gap. It didn't happen. As a matter of fact, for many years now, we've got a 1%, less than 1% growth rate. The official unemployment rate is still 32% and going up. It's worse than it was in 1994. But I think the most damning thing with regard to Black Economic Empowerment, and the ANC is absolutely committed to that, and that creates a huge problem.
The DA's Toby Chance has slammed the Mosina Makado Special Economic Zone as a coal-driven vanity project, bleeding taxpayers. He spoke to BizNews journalist Chris Stain.
Now, which companies have committed to invest there?
This is another bone of contention, because in the question that I put to Mr. Tao at the beginning of the year, I got a response that upwards of 8 billion rand had been committed, but the number of companies is actually very small. We're only dealing with two companies actually, which is MC Mining, which is the company that is mining the coal. And it used to be Coal of Africa, but it's now been bought out by a Chinese investor now called MC Mining. And then Kinetic, which is another Chinese-owned company who is planning on spending money to build the ferrochrome plant, which we'll come to the details of that later. But the planned 40 billion rand that was announced by President Ramaphosa in 2018, nowhere close to that money has been committed, let alone spent. So there's a long way to go before any of those commitments can be seen to actually come to fruition. So there's going to come a time when the current minister, Dion George, is going to be called upon to make a decision on whether the environmental impact assessment was conducted correctly. And he actually does have the power to effectively close it down, which unfortunately is going to cause a bit of a stink with the mineral resources minister, Mr. Mantashe, because being Mr. Coal in this country, the whole development certainly the south side, is based upon a massive exploitation of the suburb coal fields, and he obviously would be keen to see that happening. So I think there's going to be a lot of contestation at cabinet level, and we say bring it on, because this project has been sort of lurking there for some years and hasn't really had the national prominence that it deserves, which is one of the reasons why we're pursuing it now.
When can we expect a decision?
I can't really give an answer to that, Chris. I think there are lots of decisions that have to happen in parallel. As I mentioned, Minister George at some point has to make a decision. There has to be a decision by the department as to whether to proclaim the northern site as a special economic zone. The courts have to make decisions. So, for example, mining has started. They've started clearing large areas on the south site to expose the coal seams. That is being challenged in court as to whether they have actually exceeded their authorities by ignoring permits that haven't been issued.
You can watch the full interview on BizNews TV on YouTube. A storm of controversy is swirling around the awarding of South Africa's fourth national lottery license. An Amabungani investigation revealed that Deputy President Paul Mashatile's sister-in-law holds an indirect stake in the winning bidder. BizNews journalist Kerry Lanahan reports.
The license, which is estimated to be worth more than 180 billion rand over its eight-year term, was awarded in May to Sizekaya Holdings, a consortium with political and business ties that are now drawing sharp scrutiny. Among its shareholders is Belamont Gaming, a company co-directed by Kumo Bogatsu, the twin sister of Mashatile's wife, Humile Mashatile. Belamont's other director is prominent KwaZulu-Natal businessman Moses Tembe, who also chairs Sizekaya. Tembe and Bogatsu registered Belamont Gaming in December 2023, just weeks before the license contest deadline. The timing, combined with their proximity to political power, has reignited concerns over patronage and possible interference in state procurement processes. The involvement of Bogatsu, a private individual but intimately connected to the country's second highest office, has raised alarms, particularly as Tembe has been frequently seen in Mashatile's company, including during official trips abroad and at family-linked events. In one instance, Mashatile reportedly stayed at Tembe's luxury Durban residence shortly before the ANC's 2024 manifesto launch, just weeks after the lottery bid deadline. Despite this, the Deputy President's office has denied any interference. Spokesperson Keith Kosa said Mashatile had no role in adjudicating the license and dismissed any suggestion of improper influence as baseless. Sizekaya, too, has rejected the notion that its bid was politically tainted. This is a defamatory interference, the company said, insisting it had complied with all legal requirements, including the Lotteries Act, which prohibits political office bearers from holding direct or indirect financial interests in lottery license holders. Still, the optics are troubling. Bogatsu and Humile Mashatile have previously co-directed multiple companies, and Sizekaya has not disclosed the size of Belamont's stake or Bogatsu's stake in Belamont. While Sizekaya describes Belamont as a minority shareholder, the lack of transparency has only deepened public suspicion. Further complicating the picture is the presence of the ANC-linked businessman Sandile Zungu in the consortium. Like Tembe, Zungu accompanied Mashatile to France in May for an investment conference, a trip that has since come under media scrutiny. According to Amabungane, the delegation reportedly included a businessman under investigation by Johannesburg Water. Whether or not Mashatile had direct involvement, the latest revelations underscore a recurring theme in South African politics: the ever-blurring lines between public power, private interest, and political patronage. The lottery may be a game of chance, but for many, the outcome of this tender appears anything but random.
The full article is available on BizNews Premium. And that's it for today's show. A big thanks to the BizNews production team. And from me, Stuart Lohman, until next time.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking.